Hello everyone, this is Bob Zadum, amateur radio call sign N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm reading for you today, World Radio Online, for December of 2011. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. This recording is a production of the Courage Andyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Andyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Andyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address andyham@courage.org. Our website, www.andyham.org. Let's begin with the World Radio Online News Front. The U.S. ham population tops 700,000. The number of licensed radio amateurs in the United States now tops 700,000, according to data recently gathered by the American Radio Relay League. Maria Soma, amateur call AB1FM, ARRLVEC manager, said approximately 150 amateur radio licensing exam sessions are held each week, and the total number of licensees across all three license classes continues to grow each year. How much? Decade by decade. So almost 40-year statistics show that beginning in 1971, December, 285,000. In September 2011, 700,221. As technology changes and advances, it's especially vital to keep up or be at the forefront, Soma said. I believe that amateur radio has done just that. The measurable results are our indisputable license numbers. It amazes me, after all these years, how important and relevant amateur radio remains. I'm proud to be one of the 700,221 licensees and to see this historic and important milestone. That was submitted by the ARRL. CQ adds 5 plaques to DX Marathon Awards. CQ Magazine has announced a significant expansion in the number of DX Marathon plaques to be awarded each year, according to editor Rich Mawson, call W2VU. The Northern Illinois DX Association currently sponsors the only 2 plaques, one for the top unlimited class score and one for the top formula class score. Starting with the announcement of the 2011 marathon results in the June 2012 issue, DX Marathon Administrator John Sweeney, K9EL, said additional plaques will be awarded for the following top scores. Top CW, score plaque. CW is amateur radio's way of speaking about Morse code, sponsored by Bencher Incorporated. Top Single Sideband Score Plaque, sponsored by Collins Amateur Radio Club in memory of Art Collins, called W0CXX. Top Digital Score Plaque, in memory of Carol D. Jensen, called K6CDJ. Top Single Band Scores, there's quite a few here. 10 meters, 12, 15, 17, 20, 30, 40, and 80 meter plaque for each one, whose sponsor wishes to remain anonymous. And the top Continental Scores plaque. Again, the sponsor wishes to remain anonymous. Check the DX Marathon website at www.dxmarathon.com for details on the new plaques and qualifying scores. With the addition of the Republic of South Sudan to the DXCC list, CQ has added the Republic of South Sudan as a qualifying entity for the 2011 DX Marathon. An updated score sheet, that's the 2011.4 score sheet, and updated CQ country lists are now available on the DX Marathon website. The CQ DX Marathon is a year-long activity encouraging DXing on the HF bands. Folks, DXing means contacting stations outside of the contiguous 48 United States, and they're considered DX, distant countries, or distant contacts in amateur radio commentary. That includes Alaska and, of course, Hawaii, but they're outside of the contiguous 48, so they're called DXing as well. And HF is high-frequency bands. Competition begins anew each January 1st. Details are available on the CQ Magazine website at www.cq-amateur-radio.com and on the DX Marathon website, which again is dxmarathon.com. Radio amateur among those shot dead in Salon Rampage. One of the people killed in a California hair salon shooting spree in October was 64-year-old David Quatt and 6DAC, the ARRL reported, citing multiple sources. Mr. Quatt, who had been sitting in his car outside Salon Meritage in Seal Beach, was among eight people shot dead in the rampage. He was shot in his very recognizable off-road ready Land Rover Discovery while sitting in the parking lot on his way into his favorite restaurant. A friend, Darren Simmons, W7UNI, told the ARRL. Describing himself as Mr. Kuwait's best friend, Simmons said they were off-road driving instructors. "We have been taking customers out on free off-road trips since 2003, he said. "Back in late 2007, we had some trouble communicating with CB radios in Big Bear, California. I was fed up with not being able to contact my team that was staggered throughout the line of 30 vehicles. Soon after that, in March of 2008, I contacted Gordon West, WB6NOA, and he got us into ham radio licensing class. Since then, we have had many, many off-road trips with a core group of ham radio operators and have loved every minute of it. We were a gang of four, Dave, me, Rich Guzman, KR1CHG, and Darren Simmons, longtime friend at Testa, KI60JV, said. Mr. Kuwait was in the wrong place at the wrong time and had no way to defend himself, Testa said. We are just in disbelief that he could have been involved in this tragedy. The suspect is being held on 8 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted murder. That also was provided by the ARRL letter. Now what follows is a bit of heads-up news for those people that are really into amateur radio, ham radio. The 2012 Hamvention, that's the name of the thing, Hamvention theme this year is internationally connected. Emphasizing how amateur radio continues to build connections among amateur radio operators from all over the world, the theme for the 2012 Dayton Hamvention will be internationally connected, according to General Chairman Michael Coulter, KHCI. The event for 2012 is May 18 through 20. This year, we are acknowledging the important role that ham radio plays in promoting international goodwill, Coulter said. He has added a new committee whose task will be to make visiting Hamvention even more enjoyable for international guests, according to a press release. A number of key vendors have already committed to returning to Hamvention, which the Dayton Montgomery County Convention and the Visitors Bureau estimates produces an economic impact of about $4 million for Montgomery County and nearly $10 million regionally, officials said. Hamvention brings about 20,000 people to the greater Dayton area each year. For more information about Dayton Hamvention 2012, you can visit the website at www.hamvention.org, or you can email them for more information to the word media, M-E-D-I-A, at hamvention.org. Hamvention is one word, H-A-M-V-E-N-T-I-O-N, media at hamvention.org. Again, the date for the Hamvention this year is May 18 through 20, 2012. Let's check in with the editor's log. The editor, of course, is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. Something new and some things even newer. Hope you're enjoying the new Zinio, that's Z-I-N-I-O, presentation platform World Radio Online landed on last month, Zinio.com. We're certainly excited to be here and to be in such good company. For instance, Rolling Stone, Harvard Business Review, Popular Science, Surfing, Stereophile, Smart Money, Nice Neighborhood. How do you like it? With the new e-magazine smell still wafting about, rest assured, though, that we haven't forgotten about what you want and expect more from WRO. We're like that and are committed to deliver. To wit, find two new monthly features added to the table of contents beginning with this December issue. First one is titled Incoming, this month's feedback from World Radio Online readers. You'll be able to read and react to what others are saying each month in this column. It's a place to sound off on anything in amateur radio that's on your mind. You see, we answer reader questions there as well. As we move ahead, please view it as your soapbox. The letter, page, introductory has all the information you need to be in touch with us. Find it on page 65 of the December 2011 online issue. We look forward to hearing from you. The second new feature is WRO Watch, : new products. The name about says it all. Despite our limping U.S. economy, new radios, antennas, software, and accessories are being unveiled all the time. And eager radio amateurs get in line to scoop them up. WRO will do its best to keep you up to date every month on what's breaking onto the ham radio scene. WRO's Jason Feldman will be compiling the information. If you have questions or suggestions concerning new products, please drop us a line. Your input is welcome and appreciated. Now, as far as dropping us a line email-wise, it's this way. World Radio Online. That's one long word. It's again, worldradioonline@gmail.com, gmail.com. You can find this month's new products on page 46 of the December 2011 issue. 'Twas a very good year. Looking at WRO's 2011 rear view. In January, our cover story was on a historic PJ4DD expedition to Bonaire, written expertly by DX World columnist Kelly Jones and Zero VD, because he was there. In April, let's build something, a six-element trail-friendly 440 megahertz beam made of PVC pipe and coat hangers, and it really works. In July, through pictures and narrative, Jim Pepper, W7QIF, took us retro to the 1930s, amateur radio golden years. And in August, our good friend with the handy hams, Patrick Tice, WA0TDA, offered important considerations to help a disabled ham choose the right radio. And just last month in November, a KI6OIL profile of Kate Hutton, K6HTN, revealed an avid radio amateur who happens to be one of the nation's leading experts on things that go bump in the night. We met the earthquake lady. And of course, December, and the beat goes on, we have a jam-packed edition to close out 2011 with a bang. No matter what device you're reading us on, kick back and enjoy it. And of course, season's greetings at KI6SN. This holiday season, we're redoubling our effort to find anyone roasting chestnuts on an open fire. But before we do, on behalf of everyone at World Radio Online, may the waning days of 2011 be filled with peace and joy, and may you have the happiest, healthiest new year of all. See you in 2012. It's signed Richard Fisher, KI6SN editor. Folks, as I look now at the next piece of material that we're going to be reading, I want to digress just for a second and tell you about a gorgeous picture that was on the front cover of World Radio Online for December 2011. In script, and to all a good night, for Magic Band CW Ops, Aurora makes the season bright. It references page 18. Well, we happen to be on that page right now. And it's the subject of Morse code. We often explain Morse code as CW, continuous wave, or continuous wave as Morse code, if you listen to me month by month. But this one is titled CW Sleight of Hand on the Magic Band by Randall Noon, called KC0CCR. The winter solstice falls on December 22. To be specific, at 0530 UTC, Universal Time Constant, that's international time, But the specific moment when the sun is directly overhead at 23.44 degrees north latitude is secondary to the fact that 6 meters might be hot, right? 6 meters, of course, is one of the really nice amateur radio allocated bands on the radio spectrum. Often 2 weeks before and 2 weeks after the winter solstice, the magic band has a number of sporadic E, that's a capital E, propagation openings that can make the holiday season a lot of fun. If you're a ham radio operator with a 6 meter rig, of course. It's like having on-air Christmas, Hanukkah, and New Year's parties, especially for the CW operators. For those who have not tried working CW on 6 meter sporadic E, or E, S for short, is the type of propagation that allows VHF, very high frequency 6 meter signals, to refract or bounce off a short-lived, relatively low-level cloud of ionized particles. Did you all get that, or do you want me to repeat it? I know you got it all. It allows over-the-horizon communication anywhere from a few hundred miles to sometimes thousands of miles. It transforms 6 meters from line-of-sight, VHF repeater kind of operation to something more akin to operating 20 meters during field day. Most long-distance, high-frequency contacts are made by refracting radio signals off the F-layer portion of the Earth's ionosphere. The F-layer is composed of two layers during the day, which then combine into one layer at night. F1 is 90 to 130 miles above the surface of the Earth. The F2 layer is 150 to 480 miles high. F1 and F2 are composed of free electrons and ions from the upper atmosphere that have been ionized by solar radiation. Except during unusually high solar sunspot periods, the F layers typically refract radio signals whose frequencies are below 30 megahertz, or alternately, radio wavelengths longer than 10 meters. Consequently, 6 meter signals are not bounced by the F layers like 20 meter signals. 6 meters and higher frequency 2 meter signals keep right on going through the F layers into space. The spacing between the free electrons and ions is too large to refract the shorter VHF wavelengths. However, 6 meter signals can sometimes be bounced long distances when a densely ionized cloud forms at the E layer of the atmosphere, which is about 60 to 70 miles high. This is a temporary condition and is not a regular ionospheric feature like the F layers. The cloud usually covers a small irregular-shaped area of perhaps 6 miles to 100 miles in diameter and perhaps is a mile or less in thickness. They break apart, change shape. They thin out, reassemble, and eventually dissipate. This unpredictability, both in movement and in shape, causes 6 meter contacts to strengthen, fade, come back, flutter, disappear, change polarity, and then come back again, all within a short period of time. A person may hear operators in New York one moment, and then operators on the same frequency in South Carolina the next. Some people report that when signals fade with horizontal polarity, a switch to vertical polarity may increase signal strength and vice versa. One of the fun things about making 6 meter CW contacts during sporadic E openings is that QRP stations, that's low power stations transmitting at 5 or less watts, can compete with big guns, that's the very powerful signals. A 5 watt rig, that's a radio, can make as many contacts as a 100, 500, or 1500 watt stations. When 6 meters is open, low power is not a limitation, especially on CW. Now, folks, we've been reading this for 3 or 4 minutes, and some of you may be wondering, what is that really all about? I don't think the article or the author, until this moment in time that I'm stopping it, commented on the fact that this is really the eerie beauty of the Aurora Borealis, also known as the Northern Lights. I really wonder, how many of you realize that that's what I was describing to you as regards to what the atmosphere is doing way above us at certain times of the year. I hope you enjoyed a little bit of it. It was tongue-in-cheek, but it's just another part of the fascinating thing we call ham radio as a hobby. The author continues, while sporadic E clouds of ionized molecules can develop at any time, there appears to be two times in the year when it occurs most often. Both are around the summer and winter solstice. In the northern hemisphere, the summer sporadic E peak is more pronounced than the winter sporadic E peak. However, the fact that the winter sporadic E peak is less pronounced does not diminish its potential for fun. Remember, we're talking amateur radio fun here, folks. Besides being seasonal, openings in the middle latitudes, which include most of the United States, also have a tendency to occur at certain times during the day. In the winter, there is a small peak around local noon, but the most probable peak time is from 7 to 9 p.m. local time. Keep in mind, however, that these are statistical probabilities, like drawing four aces. Sporadic E openings can be an unexpected but pleasant surprise at any time. How far can a 6-meter contact be made during a sporadic E opening? Most sporadic E contacts are single hops reflected from a single cloud and range from 300 to 1,500 miles. If a person is lucky and there are two sporadic E clouds that form some distance from each other, a double hop is possible. In which case, a double hop is possible. These can lead to contacts separated by 2,500 miles or more. 6-meter contacts have been made from the United States to Europe, Japan, and many Pacific islands. So how does the magic happen? There are various theories about how sporadic E clouds are created. Besides being related to the ionizing power of solar radiation, the leading theory is that sporadic E results from wind shear in the E-zone portion of the ionosphere. In this theory, vertical movement of the atmosphere compresses metallic ions, especially iron and magnesium, into a thin but dense layer of ions. The characteristics of iron and magnesium ions allow them to remain charged long enough to hang together in a cloud. The horizontal component of the Earth's magnetic field also plays a role in this theory, which explains some of the correlation of sporadic E phenomenon to latitude. Now, the author goes on at great lengths about the different aspects and ramifications of operating your amateur radio equipment on sporadic E mode here, but you want you to mind your manners with respect to QSO protocol. QSO is two-way conversation between hams. A 6-meter CW QSO is not much different from a high-frequency CW QSO, with perhaps two exceptions. Point, since 6-meter openings are a bit erratic, hence the name sporadic E, and not steady as she goes E, 6-meter QSARs are usually brief. The second point, location is more often indicated by the Maidenhead grid square from where you are operating instead of spelling out your city and state. Consequently, know your Maidenhead location. 6-meter regulars collect grid squares in the same way that some high-frequency regulars collect states or countries. So I guess it's really up to you as to how you approach your amateur radio operating and what frequencies, but this has been quite a dissertation on the 6 meters and its relationships to the Aurora Borealis. And while I'm on this particular page, there's a little commentary here about pounding brass. That's another phrase for doing Morse code with your little keyers, the things that you go click, click, click with, you know? Shh! It's for Santa Claus himself. Do you have a favorite Morse key, bug, or paddle you'd like to see featured in World Radio's Pounding Brass? Send a photograph with a brief description and why it is special to you. You can send it to, this is email, worldradioonline@gmail.com. We have it on good authority that Santa Claus loves CW, and he's been pounding brass forever. Is he a radio amateur? Heck, we know. But wouldn't the North Pole be a primo spot for a bootlegger? Now, we're just saying, not condoning unlicensed operation or anything like that. Anyhow, legend has it that jolly old elf gets a shiny new Morse instrument every Christmas from the XYL. That's the wife. This year, it'll be one of those slick-looking Bengali paddles, a sculpture. S-C-U-L-P-T-U-R-E, a sculpture. Don't tell anyone. St. Nick doesn't know. We saw the sculpture at the 2011 Dayton Hamvention and just happened to snap a picture, which is shown here on page 22. What luck! No wonder Mrs. Claus thinks the O.M., that's her husband, the old man, will like it. Want to see the sculpture in action? A YouTube video features Carlo Consoli. Call IK0YGJ, that's an Italian call sign, blazing away on it at 50 words per minute. Wow! This battle is so cool. It showed up in the Wall Street Journal article titled, In Plain English, One Man's Bid to Save Morse Code, focusing on Chuck Adams, K7QO. So, anyway, even Santa needs some sweetness once in a while. Big guy, this one's for you. Merry Christmas, everyone. Richard Fisher, KI6SN. You know, there are a lot of interesting activities in amateur radio in the month of December. Here's just a little commentary about a few of them. Action on 160 and 10 meters for contest aficionados. There are two major CW contests. There's that CW again. On 160 meters and 10 meters. The annual 160 meter contest is actually on December 3. I'm recording this on December 1, so you're really not going to get to that one. It'll be gone by the time you hear this. Sorry about that. But the annual ARRL 10 meter contest occurs a week later from 0 UTC Saturday, December 10 to 2359 UTC on Sunday, December 11. This is the 10 meter contest. There is a time limit of operating 36 hours in the 48-hour time period. Now, there's also the ARRL CW Rookie Roundup, designed for the newer ham radio operator. The CW Rookie Roundup is on Sunday, December 18, and runs from 1800 UTC to 2359 UTC that evening. Rookies are encouraged to contact OTs, that's old-timers, and other rookies. OTs are encouraged to make contacts with rookies and help them out. There are not only awards for the rookies, but also recognition for the OTs, the old-timers. If you're into that, you might want to check the ARRL website to get the rules and regulations about the CW Rookie Roundup. And lastly, celebrating Straight Key Night. SKN is not a competition, but a celebration of radio. The use of manually operated straight keys, bugs, and cooties is highly encouraged. We're talking about Morse code again, folks. The event is from 0 to 2359 UTC on Sunday, January 1, 2012. Since this is not a contest, operate as much or as little as you want. Operators are encouraged to send in their SKN logs, photographs, and stories. Suggestion? Have a few friends over, put out the chips, dip, and refreshments, and have some fun over the airwaves. It seems like a lot of this conversation this month on the recording of World Radio Online is on a little bit on the technical side. I'm sorry about that. That's really the way they present the material, it seems, lately, now that the magazine has sort of broadened out its horizons to get more interested people involved in certain aspects that might not be that familiar to them. So let's take a look now at promotion and recruitment. Tailoring amateur radio messages to specific groups. The author here is Devere, D. Logan, W-N-H-E-O. Effective communication of our interesting amateur radio story today requires more than a one-size-fits-all approach. There are numerous reasons why we must tailor our message to specific target groups. First, as we know, today's ham radio is far removed from the wireless era of our grandfathers. Technological advances have moved us at warp speed into the digital era and beyond. Many of these developments, while often complex and amazing, are taken for granted by the average person. The ever-present cell phone typifies the significant impact of technology on today's lifestyle. So the once magical status of ham radio is, for many people, gone. a victim of Father Time and the relentless march of technological innovation. What has not changed is amateur radio's many enjoyable benefits and public service record. The fun hasn't faded with time. In fact, it has grown right along with our sophisticated radio technology. Today, the appeal of ham radio remains strong, but how we communicate it requires a different approach tailored to the audience. During the recent Cleveland Hamfest, a discussion by several radio club members focused on how very different people are today. Young people seem especially unimpressed with ham radio, since they are surrounded by personal wireless technology in their cell phones and iPads and whatever else. Their response to hams often is, "Why do I need ham radio when I have a cell phone?" Compare that attitude with that of many senior citizens. During presentations at our local senior center, we found that for many who grew up in the era in which broadcast radio was the primary medium, there was a strong understanding of its communication potential and personal value. As we approach these groups, it's obvious they each require a different style consistent with their ages, lifestyle, frames of reference, and experience. One of the challenges we face today is getting amateur radio exposure inside our schools. Richard Castanet, WD4DMZ, who regularly works with students in the physics lab at Tucker High School in Richmond, Virginia, explains his technique. "My approach is to combine amateur radio and shortwave with a number of extracurricular activities," he says. "I'll start the club members on electronic kit building, and that is when we start in with the Morse code practice oscillators and the transmitters. That segues into the shortwave and amateur radios. Quite a few get excited about amateur radio." While he plants the seed, he has little opportunity to follow up since most of his students are seniors. This underscores the importance of having links to local radio clubs that offer licensing classes targeted to youth. Just who carries a message may also determine the success or failure of the effort. Young people typically feel more comfortable with their peers, so a senior adult may find it more difficult to reach them. Similarly, sending a teen to talk to a group of local senior centers would also pose a challenge. In addition to making the message appropriate for the group, another challenge is showing how our amateur radio service is different from others, but still offers a number of features common to both. This is what marketers call differentiation and is emphasized by Theodore Levitt in his book, The Marketing Imagination. Many similar products gain advantages when they are marketed in a way that sets them apart from others. Think of how amateur radio can be made different from CB radio or cell phones. Let's look at some of the ways that ham radio compares with cell phones and CB radios. First, it would be worth pointing out that cell phones bring monthly bills that can amount to hundreds of dollars a year, while ham radio operation doesn't. Then, point, emergencies can result in power outages that may shut down cell phone relay towers. It's happened a lot in the last several years with these hurricanes and whatever, while amateur radio can continue to function. Citizen band, CB radio, and cell phones are low-power devices, while hams can run 1,500 watts. The limited range of cells and CB radios contrast dramatically with the worldwide capability of our radio service. Meeting new friends is a normal part of the amateur's operations, but cell phone users need a specific number, which excludes meeting new friends. And the list goes on. There are similarities as well as differences. These can provide us with the means of building on the benefits of modern digital technologies with which cell users are comfortable. Satellites are familiar to most people, but hams enjoy personal use of these birds and regularly communicate through them. Picture phones are common to many cell owners, but radio hams can use video as well, minus a monthly charge. Texting is also widely used today, but we hams have used a variety of digital communication modes for years, and so it goes. Amateur radio offers a long list of advantages and fun things to do, and pointing them out can be a powerful attraction to the public. There are many lists circulating that detail many of these. What media are most popular targets today for getting coverage of ham radio information? A survey by the Pew Research Center asks what sources adults rely on for information about local events. Here's the ranking. Newspapers, 25%. The Internet, 17%. Local TV, 13%. Word of mouth, 6%. And print bulletins or newsletters, 4%. How should we characterize the role of hams in helping local officials during emergencies? The following was suggested by the American Radio Relay League, the ARRL, for use during the simulated emergency test. This is a quotation. Many radio amateurs are active as communication volunteers with local public safety organizations. In addition, in some disasters, radio frequencies are not coordinated among relief officials, and amateur radio operators step in to coordinate communication when radio towers and other elements in the communications infrastructure are damaged. What are you and your club doing to promote ham radio? Let us know. Send some details to Devere Logan, that's the name, DEVERELOGAN, at gmail.com, along with some photographs if you have them. Devere Logan, W1HEO, is a veteran ham and radio club member who is an accredited member of the Public Relations Society of America and member of its College of Fellows. We thank Dee for that information. Next up here is an interesting piece about the military auxiliary radio system. It's known as MARS, turning a historic corner in support of the military. The author is Bill Sexton. And 1IN. In Army MARS, they called it the road ahead, a sort of catchphrase for the fresh marching orders the Department of Defense handed the whole military auxiliary radio system back in 2009. This month, exactly 2 years later, there's a big turn in the road looming just ahead. DoD Instruction 4650.02 was the first revision since Hurricane Katrina and all those painful lessons. The DoDI instructions updates our name with auxiliary replacing affiliate, a definite step up the ladder of nomenclature. More significantly, it elevates support for civilian agencies to a priority marching the militaries. It also states definitely that MARS must be capable of operation in radio-only modes without landlines or the Internet. The emphasis is mine. The language is a real game-changer. In the Army branch of MARS, at least headquarters has ruled out email as the administrative channel of choice, and switching to HF Digital will be a challenge for many of us, even if we are given great training. Before going further, let me emphasize, these comments represent the writer's personal take only. Where I sit, the good news is that the 24 months since the DoDI's publication, impressive strides have been taken expanding MARS capabilities on the civilian side. Today, the MARS WinLink messaging system actively serves civil entities ranging from the Federal Transportation Security Administration to a steadily increasing number of state and municipal emergency management centers. WinLink is an Army MARS directed network, but the other branches fully share in operating it, a handsome, if underappreciated, feat of interoperation. The gray area has been support for the military. That had been the chief reason MARS came into being back in 1925. Yet recent disasters have offered sadly few instances of collaboration with the National Guard and Reserves. The only real call-out, in my recollection, was a precautionary alert during the President Obama's 2009 inaugural ceremonies. One important exception, the few states like Texas, where MARS is wrapped into the state military forces full-time. There's no mystery about the reason. The most visible factor is the sophisticated communications gears used by National Guard and Reserve troops. Rare is the amateur radio operator who can afford it, and there's no stockpile of surplus radios to draw upon. As far as the uniformed forces are concerned, and for whatever reason, The manifest talents and energy of the typical Army Mars member have been largely out to pasture since C-Mail displaced the Mars Graham. That would have been after the first Gulf War 2 decades ago. Navy Marine Corps Mars surely was impacted. At least Air Force Mars retained a valuable air-ground phone patch service and provided communications support at the air bases. But at last, the road ahead looks like it's taking a decisively positive turn. During the past 12 months, with very little fanfare, volunteers in all three services have been laboring to eliminate the hardware differential. NATO uses a basic digital mode known in the United States as MILSTAT-188-110A. During this year, at least 5 tech-savvy volunteer teams have been working on digital software to replace the expensive hardware it had required. Its code writing follows the model set some years ago by the Wintlink development team, also amateur radio operators, who developed a software sound card modem for PAC-TOR 3 in similar circumstances. Interestingly, an earlier volunteer initiative produced Mars ALE, Automatic Link Establishment, an HF tool widely used in the government. MILSTAT-188-110A, married to ALE, offers a powerful capability for high-capacity interoperability. As this is written, the new MILSTAT software is still a work in progress, but the first network utilized it in beta was scheduled to begin operation in Navy Marine Corps Mars R Region 10 during early fall. For the members, there's a sort of beneficial trade-off arising here. Email may no longer be the quick and easy channel for official messages, but the new radio-only channel does provide a long-sought bridge to National Guard and Reserve support. Wintlink, though dependent on the Internet for its backbone, isn't affected since its primary customers are on the civil side untouched by the Department of Defense instruction. The present bumper harvest of innovation is a vivid illustration of member initiative, that is, bottom-up leadership. The top-down kind is hardly visible these days. Indeed, it's arguable that Mars owes its very survival to the resourceful area, region, and state leaders, volunteers all, with their ever-patient cadre of dedicated members in the field, the loyal net controls, Wintlink node operators, trainers, traffic handlers, and yes, the software development teams. In the long run, though, it's decision-making being done at the top of the chain. There is still no framework assuring coordinated, unduplicated, and non-competitive response to crisis by the 3 independent branches. Even a Mars program with sufficient resources for the mission, and that's the next big problem smoldering upstairs, the mission remains seriously hobbled so long as the sacred tenet called unity of command remains ignored. A credible theory attributes the DOD's lack of interest to the general demise of HF radio that began with the arrival of satellite communications. In the combat zones, however, high-frequency HF now enjoys a startling comeback. Its HF NVIS capability, that's near vertical incident skywave, works in a terrain forbidding to in-line-of-sight VHF. And stateside, Mars has the HF. That, to my mind, is why on the road immediately ahead, MILSTAT-188-110A and ALA and the other software creations are critically important. They're the best hope we have at this point for reconnecting the M in MARS to its historic position. And we thank Bill Sexton and 1IN slant AAM1RD for the commentary turning a historic corner in support of the military. Comments representing the writer's personal take only. Next up are Hamfest and special events for the month of December. From Orlando, Florida, DEARS, D-E-A-R-S, that's the Disney Emergency Amateur Radio Service, will operate special event station WD4-WDW from 1000 UTC to 2200 UTC to commemorate the 110th birthday of Walt Disney on December 10th. From Disney World. Frequencies are 14260, 7260, 28360. If you work them, or perhaps if you're a shortwave listener, if you listen to them and you'd like to have an 8x10 inch certificate, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to DEARS, P.O. Box 22346, Orlando, Florida, 32830. Next one, Nazareth in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. The Christmas City Amateur Radio Club and the Delaware Lehigh Amateur Radio Club will operate special event station WX3MAS. That will be on the air December 10 and 11 from 1400 UTC to 0200 UTC to celebrate the holidays from the twin Christmas cities of Nazareth and Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. The station will broadcast on 28.465, 21.365, 14.265, 7.270, and 3.850. Depending on conditions, it will also operate on PSK31 on 20 and 40 meters, 10 and 15 meters if the band conditions permit. And if you are an operator and you want to do some contest work, there are quite a few nice ones coming up in the next month or so. We'll begin with the ARRL-10 meter contest. The date and time is 0 Zulu 10 December through 2359 Zulu 11 December. The bands and modes for this one, this is a big one for amateur radio operators throughout the world, 10 meters CW and single sideband, which is voice. The SKCC weekend sprint-a-thon, that starts 012 to 2359 Zulu on 11th of December. The bands and modes for that are 160 through 10 meters, CW, Morse code. There's the RAC, Canadian Winter Contest, at 0 Zulu, 2359 Zulu, 17 December. The bands and modes, 160 through 2 meters, both CW and phone. OKDX RTTY Contest, that's the radio teletype, at 0 Zulu through 2359 Zulu, 17 December. 80 through 10 meters, RTTY/BODOT. And there's the DARC Christmas Contest, 0830 through 1059 Zulu, 26 December. That's 80, 40 meters, CW and single sideband. And lastly, there's the SKCC Straight Key Sprint, which is 0 Zulu to 0200 Zulu on 28 December, 160 through 6 meters on CW. There was a mention of that new article. It's incoming, this month's feedback, on page 65. We've arrived at that page, so let's take a look at World Radio Online, appreciating the fact and encouraging commentary and feedback from our readers. Via email, you can write to worldradioonline, all one word, at gmail.com, or the postal service address is Editor, World Radio Online, CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. Buying Ham Gear in Troubled Economic Times, Part 1. Editor WRO. Buying Ham Gear in Troubled Economic Times by Corey G.B. Sickles, WA3UVV, in the October 2011 edition of World Radio Online was a nice article. Seeing that photo of a Heathkit DX40 transmitter, Heathkit VF1 VFO, and a Hallicrafter S38B reminds me of my first station, which was similar. I think my transmitter was the AC1, but don't remember the brand. And the receiver is the same SB38B that I still use. My transmitter has long since been replaced with a Viking 2. The receiver in the photo labeled as an S38B is actually the original model S38. I enjoy reading World Radio Online very much. That feedback was forwarded by Andrew Lee, amateur call KD5PNT of LaGrange, Texas. Andrew, thanks for the kind words and for the correction. The receiver in the picture is indeed the S38. I'm glad the article brought back some warm memories. The AC1 was manufactured by Ameco and used a 6V6. I think it was rated at 8 watts. That little rig is still a prized treasure of many. While not the same as the original, all of the parts needed are still available if you look hard enough, and it would make a nice project if you wanted to build one all over again. The commentary there was from Corey G.B. Sickles, W83UVV. Now, in parenthesis, Corey is absolutely right, Andrew. There is a whole amateur radio subculture that has developed around this classic little rig. If you want more information, the AC1 Transmitter Yahoo group is a great place to start. That commentary, ending the piece, was from the editor. Let's take a peek now at DX World. Good reasons for making a visit to DXer Splitsville. The author here is Kelly Jones and Zero VD. I was recently talking with Jim Keller, KH2D, about DXpeditions and being on the other side, where you're the DX instead of the DX chaser. Jim spent 16 years on the island of Guam before moving back to the United States in 2001. During his time there, he learned many valuable operating techniques, including the art of working split, S-P-L-I-T. If you have worked any DXpedition within the last 10 years or so, you've probably run into cases where the operator was transmitting on one frequency and listening on another. Simply put, that's operating split. The reason for operating this way is to move the pile up away from the DX station's transmit frequency in order for callers to hear who the DX is answering. For example, if a DX station has generated a large pileup, that is to say a large number of amateurs from other parts of the world trying to call him on that frequency, it's quite likely that the pileup will be much stronger than the DX station's own signal. When that happens, and if the DX is transmitting and receiving on the same frequency, it can become very difficult to hear who the DX is answering. If he or she begins working split, the pileup typically moves up the band a few kilohertz. Now the DX has a clear frequency, and each time he answers a caller, the rest of the pileup can hear his response. Ultimately, this increases the amount of stations that can be worked. So after having a lively discussion with Jim about the virtues of working split, and if you know Jim, you know about lively discussions, I asked if he'd provide some insight on what it was like to manage the pileups from Guam. Keep in mind, his perspective is from the other side, that of the DX station. You can easily reverse roles and begin to understand what you need to do when calling the DX in order to put him in the log. And so, with Jim as our guide, let's take a trip to Splitsville. The goal of the DX operator working the pileup is to work as many stations as possible, as smoothly and as quickly as possible. You are the DX station. You created the pileup. It's up to you to control it. No one is going to control it for you, and an out-of-control pileup is one of the biggest causes of frustration on the high-frequency HF bands for lots of hams. One of the big problems with pileups is that many of the stations calling can't hear the DX because of the QRM, or noise level, caused by other stations also calling. The simplest and most efficient system for solving this problem is to operate split, where the DX station transmits on one frequency and listens on a different frequency, or over a range of different frequencies. That's highlighted. When do you need to go to a split operation? When the people you are giving reports to are not answering, or when you are not getting a report from the station you are working because of other stations who are continuously calling, simply when the QRM, noise level, starts slowing you down. Now here's the theory behind split operation. Split operation moves the QRM. You are no longer forced to wait for 20 or 30 stations to stop calling so you can work one of them. Nearly all transceivers today come equipped with two VFOs. Some even come with two receivers. Receiver incremental tuning on Yagi rigs, it's known as the clarifier, can be used with split operation as well. The primary goal of a split operation is to get the calling station, the pileup, far enough away from the DX station so it causes no interference on the frequency the DX station is transmitting on. For CW operation, 2 kHz is usually a good starting point for a split. You can announce you are listening up, QRZKH2D up, which is usually all that is needed to make the pileup move away from your transmit frequency. If the pileup doesn't respond immediately, and other stations continue to call on your frequency, sending up 2, up 2, up 2, up 2, DEKH2D, will usually do the trick. Simply turn the RIT, receiver incremental tuning, on, and tune up the band and listen for stations calling you, or, if you prefer, use the other VFO on your rig to receive. Tune up and down over a range of 2 or 3 kHz. Fortunately, there are a few DXs left who are smart enough to not just tune up 2 kHz and send their call a dozen times. It's hard to copy anybody, even with a 250 Hz filter, when 75 stations zero beat the same frequency and called you. So move your receive frequency around. By moving, you will increase your rate by working the good operators who know what tailgate means and the ones who quickly figure out the direction you are tuning. Now, with regard to working split on single sideband, the process of working the split operation on single sideband is basically the same, but since you need to move the pileup farther away from your transmit frequency to disable the effects of Mr. Splatter, using 2 VFOs is a must. Again, nearly all newer rigs with 2 VFOs have an A equal B button. Press it, which sets the second VFO to the frequency and sideband on which you are currently operating. Tune up or down the band 5 to 10 kHz. Find a quiet frequency. Announce to pile up where you will be listening. For example, if you are operating on 14.195 MHz, move the pile up to 14.210. It's fine to move the operators down, but the usual procedure is to move them up. Again, as on CW, it's difficult to pick out call signs when too many stations are calling you on the same frequency, so simply spread them out. Listen from 14.210 to 14.215, or to 14.220. It is very important to tell people where you are listening. As new stations arrive to join the pileup, they need to be instructed quickly as to what's going on. On CW, always include the up after your call sign. On single sideband, simply give your listening frequency after every contact. For instance, KH2D210 or KH2D210-220. It's also important to check your transmit frequency on occasion. No matter how specific you are, you will always get the guy who zero beats you and calls you for an hour. You want to make sure your transmit frequency is clear. That's why you are working split. If you listen on your frequency and find 3 stations calling, do not work them. If you work them, then you'll move the pileup down to your frequency and you'll have to start over again. It's imperative that you keep your transmit frequency clear. If you don't, the guys who are calling you there will be joined by the radio police, the guys who already worked you or have nothing better to do than listen to you, and they will begin telling the lost souls you are listening up. Next thing you know, the lost souls and the radio police have you covered in QRM. Before you begin any split operation, make sure the frequency you are going to listen on is clear and not being used by other hams. If you tell people to call you 10 kHz up, remember, they won't be listening where they are transmitting. They are listening to you. So don't plop your pileup down on top of somebody else who is having a QSO or is using the frequency. Don't get carried away either with how wide a frequency range you need to listen. Usually 10 or 20 kHz is enough to accommodate half the world. One of the worst demonstrations of poor operating was a particular DX expedition back in the late 1970s. Everyone wanted to work it, and the DX operators would show up on 14.195 and start listening from 14.200 to 14.300, which would clobber who knows how many QSOs already in progress up and down the band. Start listening on one frequency. If things get difficult, spread the DX chaser out to 5 kHz, or if absolutely necessary, 10 kHz. Just don't clog up half the band with your pileup. Pay attention to your QSO rate. If you are just passing out signal reports on CW, you should be working 2 or 3 stations a minute. On signal sideband, 3 or 4 a minute. If things slow down, it's usually because your transmit frequency is getting QRM. Always remember, you are the DX. You created the pileup. You must control it. We all hear the talk after a de-expedition. That was a great operation, or that was a total mess. The difference between the two isn't antennas, radios, amplifiers, or propagation. It's the operators. Nobody likes to tune down the band and find a total mess, and nobody usually complains much about a good operation. If you let things get out of control, you not only frustrate yourself, but also frustrate the DXers who are trying to work you. If the pileup gets out of control and you can't fix it, do yourself and everyone else on the band a favor. Announce you are going QRT, that is, off the air, and go watch TV. Come back again tomorrow night. Get a fresh start. Every day in the Mariana Islands is a de-expedition. They're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in case you don't know where Guam is. So there will be plenty more guys to work tomorrow. Every now and then, stop working people. Pretend to disappear for a minute. Let the pileup die down. Let the guys with the big signals stop calling. Listen really hard for a few of the little guys with the weak signals and jot down their call signs. Then work them. They won't give up when you stop. They'll keep calling. The little guy might be running 5 watts, and he or she might be using only a dipole antenna on 20 meters. But those stations are in there. They're trying. They're not standing in line at the fish market. Make your operator's day. Give him or her a new one. We are the DX. We get a lot of pleasure from ham radio every time we turn on the radio. And it's important for us to remember that every day we need to give a little bit back. Have a nice pileup. So that's a wrap. A special thanks to Jim Kaler, KH2D, for his take on DXing from the other side. That's it for this month's column. I look forward to hearing your comments, complaints, whatever's on your mind. If you have a story or opinion you would like to share, please send it to me at n0vd@dxcentral.com. Look as well for me on Facebook or Twitter, and until next time, see you in the pileups. The author, Kelly Jones, n0vd. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings me to the conclusion of the reading of World Radio, the online version, for December 2011 here on the Courage Handy Ham System. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. And this recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may reduce at area 763-520-0512. Or at email address handyham@courage.org. Remember, handyham is lowercase one word, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, handyham@courage.org. Our website, it's updated every day, ladies and gentlemen. A really fine piece of work by our staff and volunteers is www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. That's about 50 miles south of Boston, right on Buzzards Bay, the gateway to Cape Cod. If you'd like to contact me directly, my email is my call sign, N1BLF@comcast.net. Since this is the December issue of 2011, that completes the reading for this year. On the Courage Handy Hem System, it's always a pleasure for me to read this material for our good friends at the system. And I want to wish all of you a very fine holiday season and a great new year of 2012. 73.